Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and proud member of the Pitcherless Podcast Network. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined, as always, by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. On this episode, we will take a look at some of the fallout from the trade deadline with a focus on the bats. We'll also talk a little bit about the failed signing of Kumar Rocker by the New York Metropolitans, and also a bit about the luxury tax system in Major League Baseball. But before we get to all of that, Alexander, how you doing?
Hey, Matt. I'm not doing too bad today. How about yourself?
Pretty good, pretty good. What's one awesome thing that happened to you today?
Today, an awesome thing.
Okay. How about an awesome thing that's happened to you since the last time we spoke? Okay, I'll widen it up for you.
I was about to tell you about this great beer that I got that has gnomes on the label. Gnome World Saison from Silver Branch Brewing. We're not sponsored, by the way.
No. just to throw that out there.
Yeah, no, but gnomes, and it's a saison. I'm having a great week. What can I say? But yeah, no. All right. A lot of work, so yeah, I don't know. How about yourself? I think you said pre-show that it's been like basically Saturday for you for a long time.
Yeah, it really has. Some version of Saturday. Lots of golf, hanging out. I've got a neighbor who's redoing his deck, pitching in a little bit there. Not much yet, but I'll be helping him out. So yeah, I mean, that's the thing about the school year ending, and you know, a lot of teachers will take on summer gigs with the little kids running around in my house. It makes way more sense for me to stay home. So yeah, every day is kind of a different version of Saturday. Although I'll back this up for just a second and talk about this weird thing. I had an exchange with somebody on Twitter, Dave Mendelson, also a teacher. And it's funny, he was talking about how August is like Sunday. And I've always felt like summer vacation is kind of a weekend, like whatever's left in June is like Friday night, right? You're done with the week. You got a little extra time. July is like Saturday and August is like Sunday. And the later you get in August, the more you get that like Sunday afternoon, like, oh boy, here it comes feeling. So it's kind of a funny way of looking at things. And obviously for all of you out there who don't get that kind of time off, I'm sure you do not feel bad for me at all. So, and that's fair. That's totally fine. But yeah, it's been a good summer so far. Looking forward to the last few weeks of it, and then getting back into the trenches and getting some work done with the kids again. That will be great. We did have something happen, a pretty big thing happened since the last time we kind of did one of these and spoke to our listeners, and that's the trade deadline came and went.
Yeah. I heard about that.
There was some stuff that happened and some players that moved. We will get to that very, very quickly in this episode. We're going to start our number of the week is going to be all about that and the rest of the episode. Really kind of the fallout for hitters, kind of like what we did last week with the impact of relievers and arms moving, impact arms moving. Same thing here with hitters and batters. Before we do all that, I want to start with this question, though. What are your thoughts on Mookie Betts, second baseman for the Los Angeles Dodgers?
Man, it's been a really weird ride for the entirety of that Dodgers lineup, I feel like, around the deadline, prior to the deadline, probably after the deadline. You know, of all of the people to throw at second, it feels a little bit strange for him, but also, like, Gavin Lux is on the IL, and I guess... Okay, I'll get to the chase about what I kind of think this is actually going on here. We saw this last year. He played a handful of games. It was about this time of year, like in the year for them in the 60-game season, if that makes sense.
Right.
And basically what it was is it was just the Dodgers trying to see what would happen in an emergency for the playoffs, if they had to slide someone over, if they'd test out a different situation. And lo and behold, he moved back. This is a perfect time for them to try that out with Trey Turner still on his way to playing for the team. He's, I believe, still hiding on the COVID IL. Hiding is the wrong word, but also kind of the right word. They haven't seen him yet. Where is he? I hope he's all right. The Dodgers in particular having the other Turner, if you will, Justin Turner, kind of leave the field during their World Series celebrations because of his own positive COVID test. Was not the best moment for the MLB, and I do really want to make sure that isn't a thing that they have to contend with again.
Yeah, so hopefully not. There certainly is some movement with these new variants. I really hope that baseball is able to get through the end of the season and through their playoffs without that kind of thing happening again. Yeah.
So, but like my opinion, baseball side first, is that this is just them playing around, and he's at his third game now. Today we're recording Wednesday night. Viewers or listeners, y'all can look at our logo, I guess, if you really want to. listeners who are like checking us out Friday afternoon or so, maybe Friday morning, you might have a clue as to whether or not he's going to get the requisite 5 starts in Yahoo. I don't think anyone's making some like earth-shattering Yahoo trades to really change the outcome of their life and featuring Mookie Betts, but it'll be nice for him to be able to slot in there. I don't personally think he's going to get to the 10 that would be required for him to get like Yahoo eligibility there, but we'll see.
ESPN. Yeah.
Wait, no, I mean for next year.
Oh, for next year. Okay. I thought you were talking about for ESPN for this year, is 10. Yeah.
But I want to say though, if that happens, or if we get close to that, if he gets like 7 or 8 and there's like a cusp where he might be eligible in Yahoo leagues, people are gonna I think really, really start to turn out the think pieces and really, really take a deep look at like, oh my god, how valuable, how high should we be drafting Mookie Betts if he's the second baseman next year. You remember when Altuve was the co-first pick with Trout all those years ago? I don't think we'll get there, but people are gonna lose their minds, I think, a little bit and push him up like 5 or 6 places on their board, and I don't know. Are you someone who routinely reaches for a second baseman or panics for like those like hard to fill positions on draft day?
I try hard not to, but yeah, I do think that there is certainly value. I think one of the things that happens every single year is you really find out how valuable those people with multi-eligibility are. So maybe it's not even just that he's getting second base eligibility, which I do think is a big deal. Maybe not quite the huge increase in value that some people might wind up saying, but it's also that he would be second base and outfield. So that gives you now 3 places in your lineup that you can move him around as opposed to 1 or 2, or actually 4 if you count utility. So I think that's a big deal, because that way when, you know, you got Mookie in your outfield because you drafted a second baseman, and the second baseman gets hurt, or the second baseman stinks, I mean, you slot him in, or you draft him as your second baseman and you're good. You don't have to think about that position later on. So, I do believe there is value there. I don't know if it's going to be the kind of impact that people will be talking about if it comes to fruition. Mm-hmm. The other thing to remember with this situation and then putting him at second is he came up as a second baseman. So this is not like brand new territory. The major league level versus like, you know, single A, double A isn't the same thing. This isn't like completely new territory for him. So there is the possibility on a team like the Dodgers that like to move things around, that if it works, that if he doesn't get it this year, it might be something they do enough next year to make things work. If it doesn't affect his offense, that's something that could come around. It's definitely something to keep your eye on, because it's not like they're just sticking him somewhere and hoping and crossing their fingers. He has some skill and some ability and some talent and some experience there as well. So, you know, if he's second base eligible next year in any of these leagues, I definitely think that's worth considering. I don't think it's worth overpaying for. And I think people will disagree on what's fair market value for him if he does wind up with that second base eligibility.
Yeah, you know, as someone who's played around, like, trying to do a little bit more than just recreating, like, the FanGraphs auction calculator, you know, someone who's actually, like, thought about, like, what does it mean to replace someone? What does a positional adjustment, what does positional value mean? The, like, collective panics every year always make me chuckle, because I think it's all rooted in this, like, big belief that you can't be below average anywhere, ever. So if your team's starting second baseman in like a 12 team league, for example, is like the 9th or 10th best, that's a big problem in the minds of some people. You know, it's like, in order to win, you have to be good at everything. Well, the reality is that somebody's starting second baseman has to be below average. In fact, half of the teams do. That's just how it works.
Yeah, right.
And I think that the sort of like panic of, oh my god, if I don't get through the darts, if you will, this year, Kevin Biggio is the one I'm being rude about, but you know, if you didn't get Brandon Lowe this year, if you didn't get oh my god, Biggio is not even the worst of these, you know, if you didn't get Keston Hira, I guess Ozzy Albies is kind of paid out, but he was drafted really high. And the reality is that if people aren't that good, they aren't that good regardless of position. And there are plenty of guys who went sort of late who are second base eligible who've been just fine or better. And I tend to think that we overestimate how much you should push someone up a board at the top end, when the reality is that positional value is all about the relationship to someone's talent compared to like the bottom end. Yeah. Think about it this way. How good you are as like an advantage is really pretty much related to like the waiver wire, because that's $1.
Right. This is a concept that I think points leagues players use a lot, which is like points above replacement.
Exactly. Well, the same thing happens in Roto. We just don't pay attention to it.
We don't quantify it the same way. I think that makes sense. I think maybe a better way of looking at these types of things isn't just looking at that one player or that one spot in isolation, but if I zig here, then I have to zag there. What does that two-player or that three-player package wind up looking like? That's where I think you can really get a better idea of what you're sacrificing. And, you know, if you can, this year, if you had waited on second base and you grabbed Adam Frazier at the end of your draft, you're doing really well. And those sorts of things happen. I know it's one of those things you can't really plan for, right? Nobody knows who the next Adam Frazier is going to be. That's the nature of somebody who kind of just rises to the top. But those opportunities are there. And to your point, they're there on the waiver wire every single year if you're diligent or you're savvy. And even if you're in a FOB league where it's not like first come, first serve, which is probably a better way of doing it, right? FOB is definitely a more fair way of doing it. There's still strategy involved in how much you spend and how much those dollars impact your team over the course of the year. So the more you spend early, the more of an impact there are on those dollars if you've spent them wisely. I think Vlad talked a little bit about that, Vlad Sedler, when we had him on.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, there is a lot of moving parts to this. I do think that there is also value, even if it's non-numerical value, to I have second base filled with a guy who's awesome. Like, I would be drafting Mookie Betts, you know, at the top of my draft anyway. If you're talking about whether you take him fourth or he goes ninth, that's just a matter of whether you want to make sure he's on your team, because you're not going to get that. He's not coming back.
Yeah,
so
honestly, you're right about that. I think the question on like a micro level, do I want this guy, is it kind of different from like the macro level? If we all make that same decision, then someone is actually perceived as more valuable. And that's kind of like a weird trend to think about. You know, at the end of the day, I don't really care that much about a bunch of people who want to waste some money in like NFBC gambling, essentially. I mean, a lot of those people that I follow that I think are interesting people. And that is their hobby. Right. And that is their way of looking at fantasy baseball. But the actual ADP is kind of like trivial at the end of the day compared to just like the fun that we can have along the way, kind of making jokes about it. So, yeah, I mean, that sounds like hearted, but like at the end of the day, like I'm not spending that money, so it doesn't trouble me that much. Where I think this can get a little bit funny, though, is if you're sitting, I don't know, maybe you're sitting in a dynasty league and I don't know. Do you have any dynasty shares of Mookie Betts?
I don't. No.
Yeah, no, me either. You know, I'm really interested to see some sort of offers that might roll in for like Yahoo based dynasty if he picks up an additional eligibility for next year, and suddenly like people are like freaking out, or more likely when he gets one or two starts away from picking up that additional eligibility. Yeah. So, anyways,
although in dynasty leagues, you also have savvy players who know that it's likely going to be a one and done anyway. So I don't know. It's very interesting. I am curious as to how this plays out. I'm curious as to the narratives involved. And, you know, it's certainly an interesting situation, but Mookie Betts is such a great dynamic player anyway, that it's splitting hairs a bit. This would maybe be more of a discussion with somebody who's more mid-level. I'm trying to think of a name, and it's not coming to my head.
Do not, but by any means, say Jake Cronenworth. He is not mid-level. You are not allowed to bring him.
I'm waiting for his starting pitcher eligibility. That's what I want.
I think the other thing really is just like, we get to see Mookie Betts do crazy things we don't get to normally see, and that's really cool. Like, did you see the play he made where he was like shifted over to the left side of second base?
Yeah.
And he like made a catch in left field.
Like,
he's really good at baseball, and it's
fun to watch. He's an incredibly athletic person. He's a fantastic bowler. I mean, like, he's pro level as a bowler too. So I don't know, what can Mookie Betts not do? One of the coolest things that I got to he probably can. After the Sox won the World Series in 2018, I went to the parade and, you know, watching like Chris Sale come by and Mookie Betts. Those are a couple of the, it was a highlight. It really was. It was cool. Mookie seems like a pretty awesome guy. So he's either genuinely a good dude or he's savvy enough to know he's got to do a really good job of pretending to be a genuinely good dude. And I really think it's the former and not the latter. So, I'm happy for him. I wish he was still in Boston, obviously, but I'm happy for him. And he's an exciting and fun player to watch. That's for sure. Let's move into our number of the week, and I'm going to hit you with this. It's
300?
No, 300.
Yeah, from Mookie Betts.
Mookie Betts' bowling average. No, that would be a pretty amazing average. No, it's 158. Do you want to posit a guess, or did you already see what this is? What the number is?
I did, so I'm going to give my favorite possible wrong answer to this. This is the number of different fake tweets about Max Scherzer going to the Padres that almost happened, I imagine, that Bob Nightingale almost retweeted.
I mean, once you get something on social media, right? I mean, you're counting each individual occurrence. I think it probably blew way past 158. Really quickly. Now that's pretty funny.
That like got national reporters to follow. Yeah, that was the thing that kept happening though. If you guys were like sitting on Twitter at the deadline, the number of like national reporters who would like basically say like sources say person going to team, and really all they'd be doing is they'd just be like stealing someone else's tweet that they saw.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And these aren't like good reporters. You know, it's weird. Like I don't know. Do you follow? We've talked about basketball, but like Woj and Shams in basketball are like the two big guys there, and they don't break things that aren't real. And
Yeah. But I think quite in this day and age,
as like the norm.
Yeah, in this day and age, though, I think that if you're going to be that person where your reputation matters more, and I think that's awesome, I really do. You have to be willing to be scooped a lot because there's just so many people on the trigger finger, and that's why you get so much of this false reporting is. There's just so much pressure, and it's a medium where anybody can self-publish as often as they want every single day, and you're going to get stuff like that, you know? It's frustrating, but I think it has way more to do with the way we consume news these days than it has to do with anything else.
Do you remember the, like, 30 seconds or so there where Chris Bryant was going to the Giants for Joey Bart and Lamonte Wade?
Yep. I do. I remember all of it. Until he wasn't. What do we do about it? You know, I think
mostly just laugh. It's not that big a deal.
It's kudos to the guys who make sure that their stuff is accurate and right, and their reporters' integrity is intact. And I understand why people are quick to report something that they see, whether it's real or fake, or especially since there's so many people out there and doing it intentionally, like trying to bait people into it. They want to be the first, and that's the price you pay, I guess, sometimes is looking pretty silly. And then of course there's the people who always do silly things and get caught in the easy traps because that's just kind of how they do business. But the number 158 was actually the number of players moved at the deadline this year. 158 players is a new record. It blew away the old record, which was 128 players moved at a trade deadline. So I guess my question here is, was this the best trade deadline ever?
I want to like come out hot with a take that I don't fully believe, but that I've heard from some smart people, which is that trades are bad, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's peel the layers of that onion.
Yeah. I think like the thought there is, and to be clear, I'm kind of cribbing this from Andrew Perpetua, who is kind of like the perpetual friend of the whoever.
I get it. I see what you did there.
he's quite active in the PL Discord, and is notably like worked for the Mets and done really, really cool data visualization, data modeling thing, created XDets, done more than anything that I've done. And one of his takes I heard from him is that trades are bad because typically they come because teams are either like in a position where they're like forced to do things for the fans or like kind of desperate or taking advantage of teams who are forced to do things that are desperate. There aren't a whole lot of win-win trades. And
Elmer Fudd for a moment there. Win-win twades.
yes. Obviously, Andrew's a... Let's jump right into like the trade that they made for Javi Baez, which I think is one of the more surprising ones. I want to kind of just like make sure that we're talking today, not in hypotheticals, because this day is not hypothetical. We're we're doing some real stuff. He was definitely on the side here. This is an example of a team who felt like they needed to do something to show the fans that they want to win their division and be competitive. And so they went out and they traded their top prospect, a like very high outfield draft pick from high school, for Javi Baez, who is really cool and does a lot of really cool things and is so much fun to watch and has been basically a league average baseball player, in spite of being really fun and cool. That is one kind of shocking, I think, if you kind of like go from like the highlights to actual like quality of play. Like, for most people don't realize that Javi Baez strikes out as often as he does, barely gets on base. Like, we're talking like a sub 300 on base percentage.
So not
is he good?
Not great.
He's probably pretty good, I guess. Is he needs to get a $200 million extension and needs to be traded as an expiring player for your top overall prospect good? Nowhere near that close. When you see the trade deadline, and I don't know if I fully support this view, but I want to make sure we can see the other side of it before we dive into like our actual kind of giddy for how cool this is.
Multiple perspectives is always a good thing.
Is like this entire thing exists because like, you know, some teams are willing to just kind of like, you know, give up, I guess. And in the process, there are a lot of really, really strange deals that happen. You know, it's wild to think that Baez went for more in terms of like prospect value than I would say like the more valuable teammates in terms of actual play went for. I would say that he was sold off for more than Bryant returned. He was sold off for more than Anthony Rizzo returned. So I just want to say like there definitely can be room for that view where a lot of this is just like teams making bad decisions, and should we be celebrating a lot of bad decisions?
So let me ask you this before I ask you to kind of go to the other side of this. Now that we've expressed or explored the Debbie Downer side of it, I do want to talk about what makes it exciting, because I really do think it was a very exciting trade deadline. But if the undercurrent is that trades are generally another example of like that business of baseball that's not great for the game itself or the players themselves, is that what kind of the undercurrent is here? I'm trying to wrap my head around it.
I think it's a little bit different than like business of baseball. It's more just like the people who do the business of baseball aren't always good at their jobs. And like there's a lot of armchair analysting there that goes on. But the reality is like, how many trades do we look back on and be like, oh yeah, that definitely worked out for both teams. One team got their ring now and the other team got their ring later as a result of it. You know, most trades, it's like you look back and things went bad. It's funny to think for the White Sox, you know, there's James Shields / I guess also Fernando Tatis trades that they pulled off. But also, do you remember how they acquired Jose Quintana?
No, I do not.
They got rid of him. They got Eloy Jimenez for dealing off an overpaid and not all that good Jose Quintana. Like they have been part of some very strange trades, some which have been like good, actually, I would say. I know that I'm trying to recall their Chris Sale trade, it seemed like kind of helped out both teams. They got some real prospects back, which they have not paid a whole lot of money to play baseball, and Chris Sale has been injured recently.
But Chris Sale helped the Red Sox
win a ring.
Exactly. What I was going to say. So I guess my question was, a lot of these trades do seem to involve cash or teams taking on money, and so there is definitely that business of baseball. Like the trade might not be great for the team in terms of like, did it eventually help them win? But it might have been great for the bottom line, which we've talked about a lot, right? Moves that. Like the Lindor trade last year. So
I want to bring up a little bit of a different perspective on those as well. I want to take a look at like the Joey Gallo trade. And also the Rangers doing business with the Yankees earlier this year, the Rougned Odor trade. Do you know how much money the Yankees are going to pay Gallo and Rougned Odor this year?
I'm going to guess, because I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing by the tone in your voice, it's going to be somewhere near league minimum.
Yes, it is. the Rangers are bad this year. The Rangers need to acquire talent as fast as they can. And in other sports, one of the ways you acquire talent as fast as you can is you pay money for it. in the NBA, there's a salary cap and there's a salary minimum. And if you're bad, one of the ways you can get better is to acquire bad contracts and picks at the same time in exchange for basically nothing. They'll have these infinitely protected second round picks that get swapped that just like nothing ever happens. And basically it's like, hey, you give us your draft pick later and we'll eat that bad contract, allowing you to sign a free agent and be better now.
Right.
Baseball hasn't been doing that for some reason. I think it's because teams have been penny pinching. The Rangers are the only team, though, that's been doing that. There were rumors the Padres were going to do that from the other side with Hosmer. They ended up not doing it, but it went kind of cool. The Rangers are basically paying the entire salaries this year of Rutgers Odor and Joey Gallo for the Yankees in exchange for more prospect help than they otherwise would have got.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really interesting and I think good for baseball thing.
Okay.
When teams that are bad are willing to take on additional salary commitment, even if that means just paying for someone who used to be on your team. Atlanta did a whole lot of this during their quick rebuild a couple of years ago. And that was one of the reasons that they were able to acquire as much talent as they have, that they've been able to like call up in the past few years. It hasn't all hit for them, but it's been really encouraging.
Right.
Because like, if all you're going to do is be really bad at baseball and try to draft, that's not enough. That will not win you a World Series. The Houston Astros acquired a lot of their talent through other means. Their high draft picks have not, by and large, been the reason why they've been super successful. I mean, there's been a few of them that have been really good, but like, you know, Altuve was not a first rounder. A lot of their pitching has been kind of like diamond in the rough, excellent scouting and excellent development. Good teams develop talent through lots of other means than just draft picks and that you make. And it's encouraging to see the Rangers as like showing off that they're going to be part of that next wave that's doing the right thing. So I want to say, like, by and large, the business of baseball direction that we saw at this deadline was mostly teams recognizing where they were, not standing pat, but also doing financial things that made sure that like the maximum amount of money that can be spent on player salaries is basically being spent. Rather than bad teams being cheap, bad teams are taking on money for prospects. That is good.
Okay. I that makes sense to me. Let's talk about just the movement in general before we start to get into the impact of where some of these players went. Let's forget all of that element, like the money and the, is this, a weird trade, is all of that. And just talk about what was the most exciting part of this for you? Were you looking forward to the Nationals trading away a bunch of talent and seeing what they got back? Were you excited to see what the Cubs were going to do? Were you hoping that the Orioles were going to acquire somebody or sell somebody? Like what was it that, or was it just kind of like, I'm a casual observer of this moment. And even though there was a flurry of activity, it was just kind of like, oh, interesting.
I was a very passionate neutral, which is actually how most of my baseball goes. I feel like I really only have the bandwidth to devote myself like fully to a handful of teams and a handful of sports at a time. And baseball, a lot of like the bandwidth I give is actually just kind of like watching the sport as a whole, because I do not have to devote that to the Orioles all of the time. Now, it's really cool when they do cool things, like, you know, the days when John Means pitches or the at-bats where a baseball goes out of the park. Those are not all of the times they're playing baseball, though. And correct. I do not pretend they are, because the reality is their window isn't open and we're just hoping that a lot of guys in AA get better. So what am I doing when I'm watching baseball? I'm watching other dudes that I love. I feel like we can have like a whole like half hour discussion of like people who are kind of my age being more like highlight and single player fans. And it's weird to kind of like recognize that I'm kind of one of them. But yeah, the way I kind of consumed a lot of this deadline was just refreshing Twitter and hoping that players who are talented enough to deserve to be on the biggest stages, to be on playoff contenders, to have the spotlight on them, got that opportunity. So I was sitting there really waiting for that Trevor Story trade that never happened, and being really upset when it didn't happen.
All right, that makes some sense for me. No matter what happens at every trade deadline, I am always looking to see what move the Red Sox are going to make. And sometimes it's disappointing when they don't make a big splashy move. Like this year, you know, they picked up Schwarber and They didn't really do anything super high profile. And in the scheme of what you were talking about in terms of team building, that probably is the best move because it did seem like talent was very expensive at this trade deadline. And it was a price they weren't willing to pay. Or, you know, maybe that's their company line and they didn't have the assets to be able to match the other offers, which is also possible. But I can't help it. Every year, I'm always so excited to see what they're going to do or, you know, and when they don't, it's always a little disappointing, even if it shouldn't be. I don't know what it is. I don't know why it's that way, but it does kind of feel like, you know, something splashy is going to happen, and I wonder if it's going to be for the Sox. I did think that, like, the Scherzer-Turner move, that was really interesting and intriguing. Watching the Cubs kind of blow up their team was very interesting to me. And then I think that the other piece of this is, and what we're going to kind of move into here, so this is maybe a great segue, is what those changes mean for those players, not only the ones being moved, the prospects being moved, the opportunities, the roles, but also how it impacts people who are on the teams already. A lot of times, you know, you'll see, like I think Marcus Stroman was all about, you know, when they announced the Javi Baez deal, he was super psyched and stoked, right? Yeah. But there's somebody in a clubhouse, and it might not be relevant to our discussions in terms of fantasy and that sort of a thing, but there's somebody in a clubhouse who probably is like, that's not great news for me that guy is coming here in terms of playing time or opportunity or role or spot in the lineup even. So I don't know, the dynamics of all of that movement and that flurry of activity really seems to be interesting to me. And you can correct me if I'm wrong on this because I'm not as big into the NBA. But I don't think that there are any other sports that have this kind of intense flurry of player movement. Hockey, to a certain degree.
I would say basketball is the only one where it's exactly the same. And basketball's free agency happening at like the exact same time as baseball's trade deadline was.
I know there's a lot of player movement in the NBA, but football very little. Hockey sometimes. That's a lot more of the off-season stuff. Even in the NBA, is it, and this is a totally
ignorant question.
It's more
free agency than it is during the middle of the season.
In season, right? Yeah. So more player movement in the NBA, but less of this, like your team could be significantly different within a 24-hour period. I mean, if you look at the teams that the Cubs and the Nationals fielded the day after the deadline, it's completely different. So I don't know. I think that there's something, it's almost like a childhood joy, like a Christmas thing that I look forward to it every single year. It probably never lives up to the hype or the expectation now that I'm a full-fledged grown-up. But there's that little childlike joy inside me that's always like, ooh, something cool is going to happen. So it is interesting that we have those kind of two different outlooks on it.
Yeah, I would say like it was really weird to check out the Nationals lineup right afterwards. I've been to more than a few games where I did not know a lot of the players who have been starting for the Orioles. Also a couple for the Nationals this year. And, you know, also just like AL East teams that have showed up to play the Nationals. There have been some really strange rotated Phillies teams that I've seen come through town. I get into a couple of games the very last week of the 2019 regular season when like everything was wrapped up, and boy, I could not tell you who some of those players were. But you know, it's a whole different thing, I think, for the NBA, where it's like all that movement happens midseason when the tickets aren't necessarily on sale yet, where you don't know who's going to show up. Actually, I want to push back.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I want to push back on like one other thing that you said earlier on about like the price being really high. And this is actually another discussion I had with Andrew Perpetua, and that, you know, thinking about it more and more, it makes a lot of sense. The prices that teams pay aren't exclusively just about how good a player is.
Correct.
It's also about their history of negotiation. I want to bring up the Mets here because this kind of like puts a bow on what we talked about before, and we'll be able to get into like some of these players in particular. But they have a history of giving up a lot. And if you go to the negotiation table and you are trying to sell them your player, you're going to ask for a lot. If your team has a track record of not overpaying, that same sort of like expectation carries over. The soccer team I'm a fan of, Tottenham Hotspur. Please, someone get my mentions and make fun of me for that. their chairman of their board, essentially the guy who like runs all of their transfer stuff, it has a like a notorious reputation for being one of the most hard-nosed and difficult negotiators in professional sports anywhere. And it doesn't always mean good things. It means there's a lot of like moves that we miss out on, but it does mean that we don't overpay for players for the most part. And we have put together a lot of the moves we have put together have been pretty good business. Whereas if you're, I'm sure you've heard of Manchester United. They have a reputation of the opposite of being folders who will overpay. And it was definitely interesting to kind of connect that reputation stuff, which is clear as day in European soccer, back to American baseball, where, you know, there's not money prices to pay, but the prospect prices are still steep if you're willing to overpay frequently.
Right.
So, you know, there's definitely some sort of like, we didn't want to pay the prices that were quoted to us, but those are determined by the decisions you make in the past. If you are not good at trading, teams will take advantage of you again in the future.
Right, and absolutely.
That's part of what's going on as well.
There were some trades where you saw the players and you were like, oh my God, how did they only get that for them? And this other trade went down and then the money starts to come in, right? This team is eating that contract and it makes a lot more sense than that the player talent is sometimes balanced out by the cash considerations or the contract being taken on, stuff like that. So there is definitely more than just the players. But overall, I would say that this trade deadline, it was a seller's market, I think.
Oh,
I think the teams
sure.
that
for
sold
sure
did really, really well for themselves in most circumstances. So
yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that was really the point I was trying to make. But I do think it's very interesting what you're talking about. The economics behind all of these things is not as simple as oftentimes we want it to be when we're talking about trades and, you know, what our team did or what another team did. And looking at just the personnel, there's definitely a lot more going on. And you make an excellent point in terms of like a track record matters for sure. All right, let's move into talking about some specific people and some specific circumstances that changed as a result of this deadline. And I'm just going to throw out a couple of questions that can hang in the ether for a moment. And then you can kind of take that in whatever direction you want with whatever player you want. And I think we'll circle back to kind of covering these as we have this discussion. But the things to consider here, like what impact does the new role have? I'm moving, like Trey Turner comes back to the off the COVID list and is playing second base instead of playing shortstop. Is that going to be something that impacts his ability to play offensively? How does he fit into that lineup? Who is he displacing? The spot in the batting order may change. The talent around that player might be greater. Maybe that takes pressure off, or maybe there's somebody who thrives with being in the spotlight. And then things like park factors, personalities, different managers, different styles, and then the people on the team, right, who might be displaced or moved around. Somebody who maybe Trey Turner comes in and steals somebody's spot in the lineup so that Trey's comfortable, but that other person now has to make the adjustments. So a lot to kind of think about, a lot of moving parts there, and a lot of people that we can discuss to try and answer some of those broad questions. And you can go ahead and start with whoever you would like. Is it whom? With whomever? Whomever?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it is whomever you
yeah,
would
it
like.
It would be whomever because they would be the object. And
right,
whom
direct
is
object,
the
yes.
Yeah, it's an object pronoun. Yeah. Did you know that I also teach the writing and reading portion
yes,
of the
SAT? I remember you saying that. That's why I posed that to you. And to show off that you're not just one side of your brained. Brain.
I can do many things poorly.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I want to talk about Anthony Rizzo, who has, by the way, been talked about quite a bit and has had a great start to his Yankees career, unlike all of the rest of the Yankees who've been playing around Anthony Rizzo during his brief time there. I think there was a stat that went around and he was like, he had, you know, like basically been batting 500 through a couple of games and like his teammates were batting at 100 in those same games. And, you know, I take a lot of pleasure from seeing the Yankees fall apart, even when it's just like clicking onto the Red Sox roster resource page and realizing that Adam Ottavino and Garrett Whitlock were both acquisitions from the Yankees this offseason. Just want to see if I could rub some salt in some wounds because I'm having a great day. But yeah, I'm actually really happy to see Anthony Rizzo succeeding there. And he's a really interesting case in like how park factors and particularly, wow, that was great. Did I mention I'm an SAT grammar and reading teacher sometimes?
Well, you got whomever correct. So now you're one for two. That's still batting 500.
Yeah, just like Anthony Rizzo for a couple
days. Exactly right.
I think he's a great case in how when you're evaluating park factors, those aren't like just like point and click park better, yay, for players. Rizzo's a guy who makes a good amount of contact and has a good amount of power, but he's not just like irregularly hitting the ball 500 feet and then grounding out slash striking out. You can see like the quantity and consistency approach versus like the moonshot approach are like two different ways of going about being a power hitter. And we'll contrast them against some other guys later. But whenever you're talking about moving parks, the volume tends to mean that like Anthony Rizzo is, relatively speaking, going to benefit more from moving to a park that scoots the fences in. You may know that in Yankee Stadium, those fences are going to be really, really nice for lefties. This trade deadline at the end of it all was a really interesting sort of like admission of like failure of process for the Yankees to me.
Yeah,
and they had to go out and get two left-handed power hitters because they didn't have any.
Right.
And they're in a park that benefits them greatly, playing in a division that where they face a lot, and they have a very, relatively speaking, right-handed lineup that hasn't been that good, that has allowed the opposing teams they faced to just deposit baseballs into right field. And they finally decided to do that themselves. Anthony Rizzo is, especially compared to Joey Gallo, and we actually saw this from Tom Petriello, MLB.com, it's the same sort of analysis. But the long story short is that Rizzo is a guy who hits a good deal of balls pulled down the right field line deep enough that playing in Yankee Stadium will change the outcome, whether or not they're home runs or not.
Right. Right.
That is a big deal.
It's a huge deal, and something it's like glaring that it was absent from their plan and their roster construction. Yeah. Like that's, you don't usually see, at least I don't think so. You know, we can talk about this stuff till we're blue in the face, but I can't imagine that the Yankees or the Red Sox or the Cubs or the Dodgers, like that we're thinking of something that they're not. But in this case, it's almost like, what were you doing? Like, I like somebody missed the memo, or they just were like, oh, this, I don't know. It's hard to fathom that an organization like that would miss that having left-handed power in your lineup is going to be tremendously beneficial in that stadium. I don't know. It just seems so straightforward and odd that they would have missed that.
The specifics of it aren't just left-handed power. It's like, we, compared to other teams, will get more value out of a specific set of players. If we want to maximize our depth and maximize how good our lineup is, we need to find guys who can put the ball into play often in like fly ball situations that maybe aren't hitting at 450 feet. Now, they have those guys. Gary Sanchez is the 450-foot hitter. Joey Gallo can be that guy. He's actually hit a whole lot of singles and doubles this year. He's kind of changed his approach. He's striking out a little bit less. It's a whole other discussion. Petriello's analysis was pretty straightforward in that Gallo already hits the ball plenty far, that his home runs are home runs pretty much everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Just ask the Oakland A's, who have a park that is very hard to hit it out of
sometimes. Yeah, right.
And unless you're Joey Gallo or Matt Olson, is not a very friendly park for home run hitters. Anyway, you know, like those two guys, like Gallo's not going to gain a whole lot. They'll probably gain a couple. Rizzo's going to get significantly better in the power department. And if we want to translate this to fantasy, I think we all do, right? We talked about this last week with like relievers and how much you'd rise up the rankings. If he's the sort of person who, let's pace it for this whole season, right? If he moves from being like a 25 home run hitter to like a 32, 33 home run hitter because of a park change, you know, add in the change in RBI, add in maybe the change in runs. Their lineup's admittedly a little bit better than the Cubs was, which is crazy to say. We're seeing him like moving 5-6 bucks up the ranks at least. So that might be the difference between where I was like, going into the season was not drafting him at ADP, because I saw him as like being worth about like the 80th or 90th pick and going towards the 50s. He's now prepared to return the value that his actual ADP was returning.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
So I wasn't really thinking about it just in terms of like the fantasy element, and that makes a ton of sense. So if not, you know, being in a Yankee uniform for next year. I'm sure he's not doing a ton to change his approach midseason, but in the offseason he may. And that's an important thing to consider. I was thinking it more from the point of view of like Gallo doesn't need to hit any more home runs than he ordinarily would have, even though he probably will a couple, I would imagine. Even if it's Cowboy. 3, 4, 5, 6, who cares? What I'm getting at is, or what I was talking about before with the Yankees, is more of the baseball element, not the fantasy element of like, even if he hits 0 more than he would have in Texas, it's still a whole heck of a lot more than the right-handed guy at the bottom of their lineup that they were putting in instead than of the lefty, right? I mean, that's the part where it just kind of blows my mind that they went into the season being like, yep, it's cool that we don't really have these left-handed people to take advantage of this element of our stadium that everybody in the world knows about our stadium.
Yeah, I think the way that I would try to put this together is, you want to think, if your team has a way to get more out of players that other teams don't have access to, you build your entire approach around exploiting that, right? If you have a better scouting director than other teams do it, and you can more accurately sign international signings that are people, then you're doing everything you can to get extra international bonus slot allocation money. If you are way better at like turning pitchers' careers around, you're actively going out and acquiring those reclamation project pitchers.
Sure.
And then you're reallocating your resources elsewhere. The Yankees should be, in theory, a team that is going out and getting those, I can hit a ton of fly balls to right field guys, and just filling their bench and filling their like middling outfield spots with them.
Right.
And they're not doing that.
They didn't,
and
they
it's
didn't
just
have
insane.
Any. that's the part that boggles my mind. Anyway, we can get back to I do think that the fantasy piece of this is also important and interesting. And to your point, how much extra value might Gallo return towards the end of this year? I would imagine it's more. And like you said, it probably justifies maybe where he was being taken.
That was Rizzo I was talking about.
Rizzo
just rises for the most part because of just like better surroundings. Like,
yeah.
He's getting
his numbers
a lot,
might
he's
not
gonna score off of more of his walks.
Yeah, right. I don't think his numbers are going to be like monstrously better than they would have otherwise been. From the fantasy point of view, it was the real baseball point of view I was talking about. So again, let's talk about Rizzo then too. Same idea, right? If you already have Rizzo, this isn't really changing much for you. Maybe trade value. I don't know. Maybe the Yankee fan in your league really wants him now, but I don't think overall that impact
is
enormous.
That's a consideration,
but these moves that happen where the player isn't just a rental and is going to be making a switch to a different place with different dynamics, off-season changes are things that they always approach each year. They're trying to maximize their benefit to a club, right? I mean, that's what they're trying to do. So I can definitely see the impact of being in a new park that's more friendly to a few more of those deep fly balls going out of the yard, helping raise the dollar value of return that you would get if you're plugging this into like Fangraphs at the beginning of next year, and as part of your draft prep, you're probably going to see that. Now that becomes up to you, the player, to decide whether or not you want to bake in the level of that Fangraphs has in terms of this year versus next year, and that's something we can maybe talk about on a future episode, like, as we prep for next year and we use tools like the Fangraphs auction calculator, what are some things that you might want to do? I know one of the things that I think you were talking about in this previous draft season was like manipulating positional value so that it wasn't skewing things more than you wanted them skewed. So I think that would be a pretty valuable future episode for us to do. But in terms of like these new places, what about a different player? We talked a little bit about Javi Baez from like the, what were the Mets doing, giving up Pete Crow Armstrong to get him? But like, what is his move to the Mets mean for Javi Baez, the baseball player, and Javi Baez, the fantasy asset?
So I have, be shocked here. Please be shocked. Yet another tinfoilish theory about player value here. The Mets are like one of the least willing to like run teams in baseball. They have like one of the lowest numbers of stolen bases in baseball this year. Javi Baez, it gets a lot of his value from stolen bases. I kind of think he runs less. He's also like hitting kind of close to cleanup-ish. He's not going to be in positions where he's going to be running so that people can score him as often as he would be if he was batting like leadoff, particularly.
Right, sure.
Which he shouldn't be, to be clear. His value is going to be coming from hitting sac flies. and I don't know, he's a strange guy. I do not think, though, that his value goes up because of this trade in fantasy all that much. City Field is also not an exceptionally friendly home run park, and he gets most of his fantasy value from home runs. So I've actually got some worries that we should be considering the team approach from the Mets in addition to like just like who he is as a player when he moves. And that's a really
particular
thing.
That's not just a Javi Baez thing, right? That's a universal thing that should be taken into consideration. I'm sorry I interrupted you there, but
oh yeah,
like,
you're right.
Obviously, we talk about a handful of players. We can't talk about every single player in an episode, but please understand that like that is something to be considered with anybody that you're curious about. Like, what's the impact? Well, Javi Baez had, where was his value? If it was steals and home runs and he's going to a team that doesn't steal, putting him in a lineup spot that doesn't really set him up to be in a position to steal and in a park that's going to swallow up a handful of home runs, well, that's probably a net negative. So, again, yeah, I know that we're talking about Baez here, but this is not just a Baez approach or way of thinking about it.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting to kind of just go look at the major league leaderboards for, like, who's stealing more often. It's really interesting. Actually, some of the smarter teams in baseball are stealing more these days because I think we're getting a better picture of how to steal effectively. The, like, the proposition of, like, when you should do it has always been pretty consistent, like, if you're able to steal successfully more than 75% of the time, like more than, not like right at 75, but more than, yeah, that's when you run. Because that's like the value return.
Okay.
The thing is, like, a lot of teams have interpreted that as just like in all situations. Whereas, like, there's different situations where stealing has more value. But also, particularly, if you can figure out how to turn someone's speed into more steals than it otherwise would be, good coaching, good selection, you know, being smart about it by using data. It's kind of like to draw yet another comparison I'm sure you're super familiar with, like the mid-range game in basketball doesn't completely die because of analytics. We just have to be smart about when we use it. The running game in baseball doesn't have to die because of analytics. Analytics should inform us about how to run better.
And right. Yeah.
One way to apply data badly is to generalize and learn the wrong lessons. One of the ways to do it well is to take a situation where typically teams aren't getting a whole lot of value and figure out a way to get value out of it. So, yeah, I think that the Mets are an interesting case where I feel like they could be doing analytics or whatever, TM, and learning how to run better. Because they got some fast players. You ever seen Brandon Nimmo run after getting a walk? He's actually really fast. He never steals, and he gets on base a ton.
That's the funny example that you pull for his speed. But yeah, I mean, obviously, things that are decision based with an organizational approach that limits the player's ability to make those decisions is going to be a huge impact. If you go from a team that lets you loose, even if they let you loose when they shouldn't, by what the data says, you're still going to get more opportunities. You're going to wind up with more bags than going to a place that hasn't bought into the idea that you should steal bases at all. Can we talk about Kyle Schwarber for a minute? And the reason I want to bring him up is because it almost feels like the opposite of what we were talking about with Rizzo and Gallo going to New York. The Red Sox brought in left-handed power hitter that probably should have gone to the Yankees into a stadium that doesn't really benefit left-handed power. So what's your take on the Schwarber acquisition for the Red Sox?
I just want him to be healthy. That's really the biggest determinant like of his value. It's just going to be when he comes back. That's going to matter way more than the park. And I don't think there's any other way to look at that than just like when he comes back, is it part of that? I think he kind of makes for an interesting case of like how we value injuries. Is that when you're in someone's lineup and you're not playing, the difference between you and like a guy on the waiver wire is like three times as large as the difference between the waiver wire and Mike Trout when he's at peak Mike Trout mode. Not being available and eating up potential PAs for like fantasy teams is a big deal. I think that's kind of like the way, like, I just want to like fantasy brain that. But if you have him stashed away on the IL spot or whatever, you know, like that's not gonna matter a whole lot, right? The bigger thing then is like when he gets back to being healthy, how many home runs or whatever is he gonna change? A few. Now, if you actually go and look at the Red Sox, he's probably gonna end up in a situation where the result is like him forcing Hunter Renfro into a platoon, question mark, or something like that. Or Hunter Renfro slides over and someone else slides over and someone else slides over, and there's some playing time lost there. But, you know, that's the more likely thing. Now, he's going to play half of his remaining games on the road, and he's really good. And even if he's just hitting doubles off the monster or whatever, and then Kyle Schwarbering himself to first base and not to second, he's still going to be, like, a valuable asset to a team that wants to win. Also, they didn't, like, dramatically overpay for him or anything,
no,
right?
No. So yeah. That was kind of my thing. Like, what about the market pushed the Sox to make this deal? Do you think that like, they felt some pressure to do something instead of nothing, and this was, like, a relatively inexpensive opportunity to make fans feel like they did something, that, you know, with a guy who can hit the ball, that can be an exciting player with a name that they're going to know? Or was there something else to this, do you think?
I think that this is definitely kind of like a statement of intent without a whole lot of extra stuff going on there. A good one at that also. Like, I like the move for them, even if he's not like a maximized by the park sort of dude. Somebody's got to play for you. And notably, like, yeah, there's the pesky pull, but right field is not exactly all that kind either in Fenway.
No,
like,
it's
left
terrible.
Field is great for getting base hits. Schwarber will be on base a fair amount, and he's also always been a pretty good, like, guy being on base. He actually could be a really interesting leadoff hitter. And have you seen who's been leading off for the Red Sox this season? It's just been whoever plays second, essentially, regardless of talent. Yeah. It's been really confusing. So yeah, I don't think it's terrible. At the end of the day, I think it'll be fine.
Seemed like kind of a weird, like, splashy move that wasn't splashy at all. I don't know. It's just interesting. I'm not like giving it the thumbs down. I'm genuinely just curious as to what you think went into the decision-making process. So that's the only angle I'm taking.
It's the sort of thing where, like, the amount of value that it could get them back should they make the playoffs, like, the amount better it could make them in the long run could be really big, without giving a whole lot. And that's the bigger thing, is, like, they're not supposed to be winning this year. They didn't make the off-season commitments to being really good this year in the same way that other teams may have. So it's a sort of, like, low risk, potentially really great reward. You know, those sort of, like, I'm currently hurt sort of guys. I mean, if he's healthy in the playoffs, he's healthy in the playoffs, and that's all that matters.
Right.
And I think also, like, you know, I'm not all that worried about park factors in the real baseball version in this case, exclusively because it hasn't been a glaring weakness otherwise.
Okay.
And when we talk about Rizzo and all that, really it's just to talk about we're confused by other approach, and they decided to do the right thing finally. So, you know, like, for Schwarber, even if it goes against him, it's not going to go against him in a way that gets him out, right?
Okay.
And outs are bad.
Yeah, right.
It's probably
going to
go against him in a way that gets him
less dingers.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
So the real baseballness of it kind of is different from the fantasy baseballness of it.
All right, perfect. No, I think that was very well said. All right, I want to move into pass-fail, and I want to talk about this just briefly. Really, the impetus for this was some Twitter exchange that I had today with our friend Max Greenfield and a couple other people jumping in. And really, I think it's an interesting topic because, and I'll explain why from my point of view, and then I'll let you kind of say your piece and tell me whether you think the luxury tax system is a pass or a fail. And we still have the off the books that I really want to get to. So we'll run a little long. That's fine. Hopefully those of you who are listening can hang with us for the extra extended time today. We were talking about the way that the teams like the Dodgers apparently are kind of like blowing through the stop sign. And the different opinion of that being good or bad. Like, for me, I don't really love any of these systems that seem to be set up to benefit the owners and exploit the players. And I understand that there's a level of that to this system, that when you're limiting upside earning potential with a luxury tax system, that's at the macro level, not great for player salaries. I tend to think, though, that's hindering maybe the upper echelon, the one percenters of the elite, the baseball players at the very top. But my big thing here with teams like the Dodgers blowing through that stop sign is that it seems to, while it doesn't violate the language of the law, right? The there's penalties and there's consequences and they're willing to suffer them, it does, to my mind, violate the spirit of what Major League Baseball was trying to do, which is implement something, because they're never going to get a hard salary cap through the CBA, to do something that stopped the kind of behavior that we're seeing from the Dodgers right now, or the Yankees of yore, yeah, or even the Red Sox.
I imagine like the Mark Teixeira Yankees. I think that's like right, the exact exactly one right. I'm thinking of.
So like the era that I'm kind of thinking about is like the post-Kirby Puckett. I remember being a kid, and that was a huge signing. The money he signed for was splashy, and I kind of feel like that sort of set the ball rolling in terms of an era of spending. So like the Kirby Puckett to when the luxury tax was implemented era of baseball, there really was, there may have been the pop-up team here and there that made it look like there was more parity, but there was only a handful of teams that were always in it, and there were a handful of teams that were never in it. And I feel like the Dodgers setting the precedent of just blowing through that ceiling that was set up to try and curb that is just bringing us maybe more, bringing us back more towards that type of thing, which I don't think is good for the game. Now, I understand the flip side is if it starts a spending spree, then the players might start to actually get the contracts that they deserve. But I don't think it's going to, I don't think it's helping the middle relievers or the minor leaguers. I think that's just helping the Bryce Harpers and the Mike Trouts get bigger deals. So I don't know. I was pretty torn. I took a pretty firm stance, I think, with what I was saying in terms of like, I think it's bad when teams just kind of violate the spirit of this and blow through it. But I'm willing to also admit that the system itself has flaws and is kind of an owner benefit system, which is something I definitely don't like. So I'm very interested. You weighed in a little bit on it, I'm interested to hear you elaborate on it a little bit more.
Yeah. I think you set the stage here pretty accurately between, I think, the sort of like different things that I think are pretty much where we're at. The negative here is like, I think for the most part, you know, like if it's pretty easy to violate the spirit of the law, then you probably need to do something.
It's probably a bad law. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Right.
Right.
Then you have made some sort of decision at some point that probably needs to be changed. The question for me, though, is like, what is really the spirit of the law? Is the spirit of the law that we shouldn't have one team that can do this, or that we shouldn't be able to have six teams that could be able to do this? The reality of our sport right now, I think, is like, count them up. Like, the Dodgers can do this. The Yankees can do this. The Red Sox can and have done this.
Yeah, definitely.
Successfully in the past. The Astros right now are in position to do this next year and are currently, because of the way the letter of the law is written, keeping themselves underneath the luxury tax this year so they can go over it next year.
Yeah,
I think
the Mets could
do this now. Yeah, then the Mets should be doing this sooner than later. Yeah. The long run of this is that, you know, the Padres will probably do this at some point, even like if they could, because they're going to get enough tickets and their local TV deal is not terrible. And they're probably going to improve because of what they've done. Right. All told, there are many teams that can spend over the luxury tax. And the way I look at it is that you should have a system whereby the richest teams in the sport can operate at that top level and really flex their muscle if it benefits the players. I don't want a situation where the Yankees have, you know, let's say, for example, $600 million in revenue and pay out $200 million in payroll because everyone else is only allowed to do a certain amount. The way that works then is, I think the problem is that the MLB doesn't have a salary floor. If we had a salary floor, then there'd be more incentive for more of the sorts of deals that shed high salary players to low salary teams. And that's kind of like how the NBA works. I think I talk about all the time about how the NBA is a really like well-administered league financially. It's actually interesting. The MLB pays out a greater proportion of its total revenues to players, just pays them out kind of as you described it, very much in the Bryce Harper's making a lot of money. And a couple other people are going to make a whole lot more money this offseason. Right. It's like, who's the best shortstop in baseball right now? Fernando Tatis Jr. signed an extension, which will not, by the way, pay him most of the huge gobs of money that he's going to make from that extension for another several years because he's on his rookie deal.
Yeah, right.
A lot of the other best players in baseball right now, like Juan Soto is barreling towards an extension, is not being paid very much money right now.
Right.
That's kind of how the league runs.
The luxury tax has not stopped or incentivized teams to avoid exploiting young talent. I mean, and that, so I don't know. I don't think that taking that luxury system away is going to see dollars filter down to the places where they need to be. They're just going to be able to go out and, you know, you're just not going to see any stars ever signing with even the top mid-level team. I don't even see the Padres having been able to do what they've done with their talent and their moves and all of that to build themselves into the position that we're in.
Manny Machado signing, for example.
If that system was not in place, because he wouldn't have gone there.
I think I'm with you in general about, like, we need to make sure that we present a system that gives, you know, the teams that are somewhere between 10 and 20 in revenue a regular shot at, when their window opens, fully going for it. And I don't think the luxury tax is getting in the way of that. I think replacing it with a salary cap, like a hard cap like the NFL, probably wouldn't fix that either. But again, I think the bigger problem in terms of, like, what we should care about is pretty much always going to be salary floor. We get so many more, by the way, interesting deadline moves. Guys like Eric Hosmer had a particular reason for teams like the Tigers or someone to want to acquire him, because they have to make a salary floor, and if they don't do it, then all of their other players just get a raise. Like, that's how it works in the NBA. You have to be at a certain level of the salary cap, or else everybody just makes more money anyway and you don't save the money.
Okay, so now, yeah, you're totally incentivized to spend it.
Now, what gets in the way of that? And this is kind of like the point that I think is the biggest thing, is like, there's CBA negotiations regularly. The MLBPA's most recent negotiation for, like, the last CBA, not the current iteration, not the current players who are, like, doing things. Like, the things that they bargained for and cared about were a lot of small potatoes, like a lot of just, like, amenities, if you will. They're like, hey, we're willing to cede ground on a lot of different issues if you're willing to get us some nicer team hotels and improve our clubhouse food and stuff like that. Rather than, hey, we're going to go on strike if you don't make it so the players in the minor leagues don't pay their entire salary to the team hotels, or so that the rookie on our team who just got called up gets paid, like, and, you know, like, really, the reality is, like, the minimum salary for the relievers who are getting traded around constantly and having their lives just uprooted constantly isn't, like, enough that, like, when they retire in a couple years, they're out of money.
Because
those guys make the league possible, and, you know,
Now, there is something you brought up earlier that I want to circle back to, because I think this might actually be a driving force between my different perspective on this and some other people. And maybe it is a little bit generational. And that is that if you're somebody who roots for players and talent, you don't really care what team they're on and you don't care what team they win with. Whereas for me, I'm thinking about this like, okay, the Detroit Tigers or the Pittsburgh Pirates fan base, right? You want the Pirates to at least be able to field a team that they feel like has a chance. And when there was no luxury tax system, like, they just never did. So I can also understand that. And that was not something I had considered before, that if you're more of a, I don't care what team Tatis Jr. is playing for, I just want to watch him win a World Series, then you really, you're watching it from your couch in your living room. Who cares geographically where he's doing that? I can understand why that would maybe lead you to say, like, just get rid of the luxury tax, blow through it, spend as much money as possible, blow it off, because who cares if they're small market teams? I'm rooting for big market players. So I can understand that too. Yeah, that's not where I'm at with it, but I get it.
Quite where I'm at either, but I do kind of get that point of view, and I don't think it's far off from where I am. I would say it's like, I'm going to cheer for my local team, and I want, like, you know, I believe in baseball teams as, like, public amenities, essentially, right? I think of them as like a local product, and I want my local community's product to be good because I want kids to play baseball, and, you know, I want people to be able to go to baseball games. So that's, and I want them to enjoy them, not just when the Yankees are in town.
Yeah, right.
The way that I consume baseball, though, does not always work that way, because that is not always a reality. And I think that's part of it. My perfect world is, you know, we got a salary floor and we have, like, a progressively more strict salary cap system where, you know, like, you can go over it a little bit and the penalties aren't that harsh. And you go over it by a bit more often and it's harsher. I think, though, like, and I think this is kind of the point I made online, is that the Dodgers have enough money and they make enough in revenue based off of where the current salary cap, or not salary cap, you know, luxury tax
threshold,
line is, though,
yeah.
that it's just, it can just be the cost of doing business. And if they're losing international allocation money, and if they're losing draft picks to win two World Series in 3 years or whatever, or three and four,
yeah,
or whatever
it
comes to,
yeah,
you know, it's worth it to them.
Right.
And they should do it because that's how the rules are currently written.
Sure.
And the thing that I think is more dangerous than parity being threatened by one or two teams really gunning for it, because right now I don't think parity is being threatened. We have a really interesting situation where are a lot of teams who could do it.
I agree, but I think the luxury tax has brought the number of years we've had it has brought us to this point, and I'm not sure that it's as easy to draw the straight line between those two things, but I do think that there's a large influence there.
Now, here's what I think is kind of like the puzzle piece that has changed things. The Dodgers ownership group, being a very large ownership group that is very kind of hedge fundy, where it's not just like one inherited wealth dude who's making some miserly decisions. That's part of it. The Padres are acting very much as a go for it team. The Yankees have this tradition, blah, blah, blah. But
yeah.
Like, we're seeing a lot of the competition, a lot of things that are really interesting, driven by really wealthy like units that are finally seeing how the game is played and playing it correctly rather than just kind of like their money. The problem with the luxury tax, I think, is when teams use it as an excuse to not spend rather than when teams blow through it. We have not typically had worse off situations when they've blown through it.
I can admit that there is an element there that, especially from the player side, that perhaps I was not considering before. All right. Well, you know, shoot us emails, send us some tweets there about what you're thinking there at home about all of this. I think it's a really important discussion that shouldn't just pop up around the trade deadline. I think these are the things and the elements of baseball that really do impact your enjoyment of the game. Whether it's your team or your player, the on-field product, the strategies, all of that. So, I want to keep this conversation going. We can certainly do that online. Let's talk about off the books. And this is another one of those kinds of business of baseball and how rules work. And it's related to the draft and the Mets and not signing Kumar Rocker. There's a lot of moving parts going on here, and I am going to admit ahead of time, I'm not sure that I fully comprehend or understand all of them. I'm not sure if all of the reporting has been 100% accurate. I believe that the reporters are reporting things they're hearing. I just don't know if that's actually what happened behind the scenes. There's potential injury stuff going on. I'm going to try and set the stage here for you, Alexander. You correct anything you think I get wrong here, please, because it's about, honestly, if I get something a little bit wrong, I don't want that misinformation out there. And then also kind of your take on it. From my understanding, there's the pre-draft physicals. Rocker chose not to participate. Again, my understanding is that for high draft picks, it's not that unusual because it doesn't usually dissuade teams from drafting them. So this wasn't just like a Scott Boras being Scott Boras thing or Rocker necessarily hiding something or being sketchy. It's kind of like the MO of top level draft picks that are just kind of like, I'm not doing that. Right. So, but that did happen. Now, when that happens, the team, if they don't sign that player, would still get their compensatory pick, right? Because they didn't, the player didn't participate in the physical. So
this is bigger than that.
I
want to say like that rule kind of applies in more cases. Do you remember when the Astros didn't sign Mark Appel?
He
was the number two overall pick.
I remember the name Mark Appel.
Yeah. This is like 2012 ? I could be wrong. Somewhere around then that they had like one of the top overall picks and he doesn't sign with them.
Yeah.
They end up getting that pick back essentially the next year. And you just get to pick twice in the same draft and like
Right. So
they'll just have the same pick next year.
But if he had taken that physical, right, and they didn't work it out, they wouldn't have gotten if they didn't make the offer. Because this is the next piece of it. There was reporting that came out that once the Mets had kind of floated an offer, but once they didn't get the medicals, they just never made another offer. Now, normally, if they don't make an offer of a certain percentage to slot in this circumstance, they would lose the compensatory pick. But because he didn't take the physical, they didn't have to make the offer and can still get the pick. So the question becomes, like, did the Mets really ever even plan on making the offer, or were they using the fact that they knew he didn't take this physical as an opportunity to just get this pick next year? Now, the question then becomes, why do that? Why bother? Why waste the pick? And I guess the answer could be something about money or strategy. I don't know. I really don't know. But it brings me to this. This is my point of the whole thing. Now Rocker can't do anything with Major League Baseball for a year, whereas the Mets will basically get this pick again next year plus the pick they already had. So the organization is damaged, like, very little, and the player is damaged a whole heck of a lot, where that puts the pressure then on the player to take a bad deal and not the billionaire owners to have to sign the player. So that's where it's sticky for me. That's where I really don't like this at all, if I have my facts straight. Because I whether or not he's injured and is hiding something, like, that's all remains to be seen. And if he is, sure, the Mets aren't going to invest in that. But the system, again, talking just about the system, seems to be set up where teams are damaged, like, not at all for doing this kind of thing. And the player is damaged a whole heck of a lot. I mean, an entire year of professional play and development and being with a team and in an organization, that's a big deal. So, again, please correct anything that I said that you think is a little off or inaccurate. And I'm very interested in your take on this. And then obviously the Stephen Cohen tweet that came out afterwards as a follow-up to this, where I think he thought he was defending himself and it really wasn't. So go ahead. I'll stop talking now.
Yeah, I think you're totally right about, like, everything you said. The other angle of this that he particularly brings up that I think is kind of galling is he basically says, you know, like, the slots are worth like five times more than the players themselves or something like that. Let's take the conclusion.
Yeah, I've got
that,
the quote here, what he actually tweeted out. He said, education time, baseball draft picks, which was like, I'm going to stop for a second, which, by the way, is such a jerky way of starting this. It just is like, oh, I'm so much smarter. He's a smart dude. He's made billions of dollars. Fine, but, like, come on, man. Anyway,
did he go to, like, the classes where all of the other, like, billionaire owners teach each other how to be billionaire owners? That,
yeah, it's like the opposite of Manor School. education time. Baseball draft picks are worth up to five times their slot value to clubs. I never shy away from investments that can make that type of return, which he thought was a defense of, obviously I tried to make this happen. Why would I walk away from it? But really, it's an indictment of just how exploited these players are. And he didn't even get it. So go ahead.
Yeah. No. So that's kind of like the admission, though, that. Right. In terms
the quiet
of like
part
the amount
out loud.
Of, yeah, exactly. That's like someone like Kumar Rocker, and not exactly him. Let's set aside all of the particulars here, because I actually think they're kind of less interesting than, like, the long run. This dude just acquired a new team and has gobs and gobs and gobs of money that he and his family and his grandkids and great grandkids will never be able to spend. Mm-hmm. And you know, the way that it works then is that he's going to generate more potential profit for his team by four or five times than these players are worth, and that's the way that the league operates, and he's just said it out loud. In particular, though, it's kind of weird to think of it, though, that, like, before a player is even signed, just the rights to continue to operate the system, and that's what it is, just like the ability to continue to just play owner will net you a bunch of money. You don't have to make choices, just the potential for it is itself worth so much money. And I don't think we operate the sport that way. You know, it's like, we don't think, like, how much is Casey Mize worth? You know, he's the number one overall pick a couple years ago, and he's been kind of like Mize planned by the Tigers, as they're kind of calling it, where they're like, instead of the Strasburg plan, where they just shut you down, he's been, like, turned into, like, a long reliever every 5 days to protect an asset that's worth a lot for them in the future whenever their window and their value is aligned. And it's all really kind of weird to hear people described as assets or investments.
Right.
But also, like, the reality of it is that the way that they run their league with the luxury tax considerations as well doesn't work if you don't have a system where someone like Kumar Rocker gets paid a couple million dollars, maybe. Not all of them do. A lot of the guys who go to the top 10 get paid under slot, and that's part of team's plan. You know, they get that money, and that's like most of what they'll make for the first 5, 6, 7 years they play professionally.
Right. Exactly.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's the system, is that your best players, if they're super talented, will get paid a signing bonus essentially for the first 5 to 6 years they play professional baseball. And then maybe 3, 4 years in, they get paid $600,000 a year.
Yeah, which is, I mean, and now this player is missing out on his first year of being able to do even that. So when he starts again next year, it's going to be at the beginning. Like, I just don't understand why you draft somebody. It's not like the rumors of his health weren't out there. Like, what information did the Mets not have? Just that they didn't get this physical report, that they knew they wasn't out there? I can't wrap my head around why they did this. And I think even though this doesn't happen all that often, what it does is it's a case that shows the flaws of the system and highlights, especially given Cohen's comments in that tweet, that baseball is and has always been built on the exploitation of its players, especially early on. You know, we see these huge contracts being signed by you know, like I said, the Harpers and the Trouts of the world. Even Tatis's deal is probably way under market for what he would have gotten.
That's the other side of it, actually.
Right? Like, and so at every turn, like, there's this
most
exploitation.
Most of the guys who are like really, really, really valuable. For the years they are most valuable, they are dramatically underpaid. For the first few years, a guy hits his like actual free agent years, he's maybe still underpaid. Like you can think of like, I mean, Max Scherzer signed this like 6-year, $200 million contract. He was underpaid for most of that relative to how good he was. Those contracts are like 10, 12 years long because you're basically getting paid for 5 or 6 of them. And then the rest of it, they're just continuing to pay you out while you continue to play baseball. Like, that's how that works, is that, like, when Lindor signs his deal, in theory, he's worth it for, like, Mookie Betts, right? He signs his, like, 12-year-long, $300-plus million deal. He's worth $50, $60 million a year for the team for, like, the front half of it, and then, you know, like, $10 million a year for, like, the back half of it on average. So, like, yeah, like, you have to basically sign away the rest of your career to a club in order to get paid out what you're worth. That's the only way that things work.
And it doesn't happen for most of the players. It happens for a handful, yeah, comparatively speaking. And I don't know. I feel like these systems of baseball, they're either set up to exploit players and player talent, or the ones like the luxury tax that was kind of, I really do think that it was set up to try and create parity in the league. That system can then be exploited in ways that aren't good for players too. Like it's very, very frustrating. We got two examples there of what this can look like. Again, I know that this Rocker situation is not common, but that doesn't mean that it's not the same exact system all these players are going through. And maybe this sort of thing on a smaller scale and in other situations is happening more than we realize. And it's just happening with not with first round players or players that had as much of a spotlight on them. I mean, obviously Rocker and Leiter had a lot of spotlight. Social media played a huge role in that. So I don't know. It rubs me the wrong way that this worked out the way that it did. Now, if Rocker was like trying to hide an injury, that's not great either. Like, I get that. And I understand the Mets not wanting to invest in that. But at the same time, the Mets aren't punished for kind of messing with this kid's development. So and he is big time.
Yeah, I mean, it's all pretty straightforward at the end of the day, and that's what sucks.
Yeah. Well, on that note, that's gonna bring us to the end of this extra long, extra large sized episode of Dugout Study Hall. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us for the ride. Alex, obviously, thank you for being a part of this, as always. And if you could let the people at home know where they could find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.